Looking for a Honda? Get to RauschHonda.com. Save thousands on a great selection of new and certified pre-owned Hondas. Buy or lease, cars, trucks, and SUVs. Preview them at RauschHonda.com. And remember,
the best way to see Honda is Roush Honda.
By the way, if you miss Saturday morning open phones, any or all of it, it's available for you. Go to 610WTVN.com, BC on your PC. And it's all right there in shining glory. We are at 645, 610 WTVN. It's 26 degrees. Spend a couple of minutes with Matt Mayer, visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and author of Homeland Security and Federalism, Protecting America from Outside the Beltway. And you're of the mindset that the economy is our biggest security threat, Matt, is that right?
Well, it's definitely going to create a greater security threat when it comes to the threat from radical Islam, yes.
Okay. So you're of the opinion that the risk of terrorism increases substantially during times of economic duress. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, if there's a lot of debate on whether poverty and radicalism are linked, but there can be little debate that where there are lack of opportunities and an increase of alienation and disaffection among immigrant populations, that that's going to increase the risk of jihadism, just simply because it creates a more fertile soil for those folks to plant those seeds and let them grow.
And you're talking about the Muslims living in this country or in Europe?
Well, frankly, all over the world. I mean, you know, you have places in Europe, obviously the Ban Louis outside of Paris. You have these Turkish neighborhoods in places in like Berlin. And then you also have places in Malmo, Sweden, in Netherlands, things like that, where you have huge groupings of immigrants. And they can't get jobs. They have high unemployment rates. They have very little interaction with the main population. And so there's lots of alienation and disaffection among those groups where the seeds of radicalism can get planted and absolutely grow. Here in the U.S., you know, what we've noticed, of course, in the Somali population in Minneapolis and in Columbus, that there is this risk and growing concern of these young men leaving the U.S., going back to Somalia, and joining this radical group over in Somalia, and then possibly coming back to the U.S. or Europe to do after having been trained. And there's reports even yesterday of Somali radicals coming back to the U.K. having been in Somalia receiving some training. So that concern is a real concern.
Huh. Well, I knew they had, within the last couple of years in Paris, had some very ugly rioting and burning. And you feel that that's evidence of what you're saying?
Absolutely. You know, the most folks think the Europeans are far more sophisticated when it comes to immigration and integration of populations than here in the U.S. And it's actually exactly the opposite. They're it's very hard if you're an immigrant in Europe to get a job, to become assimilated into the population, whereas in the U.S. we've had a far easier time doing that for lots of different reasons. But that has happened over in Europe, and so I think as you see greater economic uncertainty, that's going to create greater disaffection among those populations that are already having a very difficult time assimilating into the populations.
So apparently there is no end in sight, that it will continue until something pops, and then it'll be too late.
Well, you know, that's the fear, and when, you know, we're doing what we can to stop anything from happening, but and at the end of the day, you have an enormous amount of will by those who wish to do us harm, and they don't stop thinking about it no matter what we do.
Aren't there large populations of Somalis in and around Minneapolis and somewhere in northern New England, New Hampshire, or someplace? Why do they pick those cold weather areas?
Oh, you know, I think what it has to do with is just that you end up getting a number of folks that could get there first, and it creates critical mass that then it becomes essentially a place that they go because they have family members then come, and then relatives and friends come, and it just becomes a larger and larger group, frankly, because it allows them to have some level of comfort in being around folks they know and have some familiarity with. And so the Minneapolis, which is the largest Somali group in America, and then in Columbus was the second largest, that just became two places where you had just this critical mass develop, and then now it becomes a very vibrant community.
So while they're here, they do not take part in assimilation at all. They're happy just to stay in their own neighborhood?
No. I think there are lots of efforts to assimilate among both groups, and the groups in Minneapolis. You know, those folks have been there for quite a while. They're mainstream members of the Minneapolis community. You know, doctors, lawyers, you know, you name it. In Columbus, it's a newer population. I think there have been more difficulties in that assimilation process, but they're definitely trying. What you have, though, is where you have this, and I know this has happened in Columbus, where you have potential issues among the Somali, the young men coming in from Somalia, as well as your African-American populations of where they're in the school systems. And so that tension, because there's a lot of differences, has created this environment where there's a risk some of these young men, like they've done in Minneapolis, they essentially disappear, which is they use their passports. And they go back to Somalia and join the radical Islamic movement there that is taking over over the country.
I see you have an insider's view of Hurricane Katrina. What did you do there?
Yeah, I was with the department during Katrina, and so I was in the secretary's office and spent a lot of time on the crisis management and the response of that, which obviously the response was not very good at many levels of government. And there are lots of reasons why that was the case, but we spent a lot of time trying to fight with Mike Brown at the time to try to get information, and Mike was really not sharing that information with the department, and so it was very difficult for the secretary to release assets and resources to try to help down in New Orleans, because we just simply had no in-theater visibility of what was going on.
And much of what happened, you say, during Katrina is not public?
There's a lot that never made the news stories. I mean, we don't talk about all the times. You know, for example, on the Wednesday after Katrina, you know, I spent like 12 hours trying to track down Mike Brown through every communication device, through anybody I knew that would be around him, so that he would call the secretary to give the secretary information on what was going on, what was needed, what could we do. And, you know, it took 12 hours for him to call the secretary back in order for us to then try to release assets that we had at, you know, TSA, which is the Transportation Security Administration, or Customs and Border Protection, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I mean, there are a lot of assets in the department that we were able to use eventually, but it took trying to get information out of Mike Brown and FEMA in order to do that.
Was all of that money allocated to Katrina actually spent?
Some of it has been spent. Some of it is still in the pipeline, and some of it has been spent unwisely, as audits have shown. And that's always the case when you have enormous amounts of federal spending. There is always going to be a lot of misspending that occurs.
I wonder if that'll be the same with the stimulus money that's about to be released and put into the pipeline.
Yeah, of course it will be the same. It's it's impossible not for it not to be the case, because there just is so much money. The folks receiving the money don't have the ability to deal with that volume, and so things get done on the fast, and that always leads to misspending.
Well, this bill is going to be signed tomorrow, and it finally came together over the weekend. That's a real short window there.
Yeah, it's a real short window, and you know, we're still trying to unpack what exactly is in that over 1,000-page bill. And so, you know, once we figure out what's exactly there, then folks will figure out how to try to start spending that money. But it's going to be pretty messy.
That is Matt Mayer. Matt's a visiting fellow, Heritage Foundation, author of Homeland Security and Federalism, Protecting America from Outside the Beltway. Some would fear what goes on inside the Beltway.